you tell me about how the college course came about, how long you've been teaching it, how it's developed over time?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I am a full-time professor in the fiction writing department at Columbia College in Chicago. And I teach a number of classes, but my biography, my first book on Ray Bradbury, I've written two. My biography, The Bradbury Chronicles, came out in 2005, and it just seemed like a natural extension from the book to teach a class that was centered upon the works of Bradbury. We've got a really sort of diverse curriculum in this department, and we offer critical classes that show writers, give writers an opportunity to examine, short stories or novels, but also sometimes specific writers, and really spend a semester deeply rooted in studying, a specific writer and how and what they can take away through that study in terms of their own writing. So I just sort of put a course proposal together to my chair and said I'd love to teach a class on Ray Bradbury, and he was ecstatic about it. And so I've taught this since it's my fifth year teaching the class. I start up again next week with a new section of the course in 2 weeks, I guess. And it's just a really, wonderful opportunity to spend a complete semester reading nothing really but Ray Bradbury. We read three novels. We study about 45 short stories. It's important that I try to pick not only a selection of material that spans his incredibly long career. He first published in 1938, and he's been writing ever since. But so I not only span the entirety of his career, but I also want to show just how diverse his writing has been. I think it's been a disservice, really, to just call him a science fiction writer. He's so much more.
Uh-huh.
He's obviously a fantasy writer, a science fiction writer. He's written mysteries. He's written straight up literary fiction, and those, many of those stories have been collected in magazines like Harper's and Esquire and The New Yorker, along with his multimedia explorations into film and television and radio and theater. So we spend a semester long just deeply immersed in all things Bradbury, and it culminates the last couple weeks of the class. I bring the students to a conference room, and we sit down with the conference telephone, and we call him. And it's really neat to see the expression on the students' faces when they hear his voice. I mean, it's not every day that you can spend a semester in a college studying a writer and then interact with that writer. You can't call William Shakespeare or Ernest Hemingway or so many of the others. So it's really a real fun class to teach.
Have you maintained your relationship? How frequently do you talk to Ray?
Quite often. I just saw him 2 days ago for his birthday.
Right, just turned 90,
I visited
right?
him. Yeah, he just turned 90 on Sunday. He lives in L.A., and I see him at this point probably once a month. I travel out to Los Angeles from Chicago and still see him. I talk to him weekly. As this new book has come out, I don't know whether you got it. I told my publisher to send it to you.
I haven't gotten it yet.
I hope you received it. Frustrating. I will call them today and make sure that they sent it. This new book is a collection of all my interviews with him, called Listen to the Echoes, the Ray Bradbury Interviews, and it's a decade's worth of interviews. And that's really caused me to see him a lot more because we've been doing events together. And we've done some really singular events. I was in New York City a month ago, and we Skyped with him. We utilized kind of the Internet, which I think is ironic, given what he envisioned in Fahrenheit 451 and over-reliance on television, and here we are relying on, a flat panel wall screen, television screen, to interact with him because he no longer travels. So I've seen him a lot. We talk all the time. We're working on a few new projects together, so he's just really, we're still quite close.
How's his health?
His health, it's what you would expect for a 90-year-old. It's not terrific. His will to live and his spirit burns so bright, it's remarkable. I've never seen anybody in my entire 43 years, never witnessed anybody who yearns to live more. He loves life and desperately wants more time on this earth to create and write and celebrate living. He just loves life. But at 90, it's getting harder. You know, he suffered a few strokes about 10 years ago, one in 1999 and another in 2000. So he's pretty well confined to a wheelchair at this point. He can stand with the aid of a walker and move about the house a little bit. But, you know, his health has declined. But his mind and his energy and his humor and his ideas are as vibrant and vital as ever.
Did you imagine 10 years ago that your magazine article would turn into this?
I had no idea. I mean, I grew up with him like so many young readers did, and was a very frequent contributor to the Chicago Tribune magazine, and the editor said, come in and pitch, you know, four or five story ideas to me, and one of them was, couched within four other ideas. One of them was a profile of Ray Bradbury, which, to be honest, I mean, I loved him as a child, and so there was a selfish reason to profile him. It would give me an opportunity to meet him, and I always knew that his story was remarkable, and I thought it was a great time to write a story of it about him. He was turning 80 that year. I thought it was a great time to profile one of Illinois' most famous literary native sons. He is intrinsic to the literary fabric of the heartland. He's one of our great Midwest writers. He tells a small town story like almost no other writer can do, if you've read Dandelion Wine or Something Wicked This Way Comes and many others. So I had no idea. I went out to his house and met him and interviewed him, and it was a remarkable opportunity and a great visit and a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and I didn't expect it to go anywhere from that point on. But as I was walking out of the house that day, he said, stay in touch with me. And I said, I will. He said, no, I mean that. I want you to stay in touch with me. You love my work, and you're very educated in what I've done in my life, and I'd love to stay in contact with you. Come back and visit me soon. And he was very insistent upon that, and I had, you're a journalist, and you don't hear that a lot from subjects. So I took him up on the offer, and I went back 2 months later. The story had come out in the Tribune, and he loved it, which was pretty moving to have someone of that stature sort of, confirm that my writing was okay. And he read it and loved it, and he said, you know, I've got an idea. Why don't you write more magazine stories about me, and that gives us a chance to get together. So I did that. I wrote a few more stories about him, and we sort of struck up this really tender father-son relationship, stayed in regular communication, and I visited him more and more. And that ultimately resulted in my book. I realized in doing these magazine articles, I knew full well there was no reference book on his life. There was no place for a journalist who wanted to do a profile of Ray Bradbury to go to a single source to get all the information he needed. There was no place that chronicled, if you will, this absolutely remarkable, varied, diverse, really productive life story. And so I asked him, I said, you know, would you ever be interested in doing a book together? And I said, there's just no biography on you. Why is that? And he said, because, you know, I think a biography means your life's over. It's the life story. And he said, I'm 80. He said, if you call me in 30 or 35 years, maybe we could get working on this. That gives you a sense of his life plans here. But I saw an end. I recognized that it wasn't an adamant no. He was humorous about it, and I sort of stayed after him very gently. And a few months later, he turned to me at lunch and said, I've given some thought to this book idea. Why don't you go ahead and get working on it? And that's how that first biography started.
Why did he never write an autobiography or an autobiography of his life up to that point? Because it seems, I mean, there are passages in your book that mirror passages, for example, in Fahrenheit 451, you know, the idea of the five lady fingers is there, and it's in both books basically. Mm-hmm. So I mean, he's given a lot of insight, I guess, or a lot of he's given hints of that biography, but never seems to have collected it.
Yeah, you know, you just, I think, kind of answered it. He would tell you, I've worked with him so closely now that I can answer questions and I can hear exactly how he would respond to you. He would say, because my autobiography, it's all in my books already. He said, if you read The Lion Wine, you get my story in Waukegan and how I turned it into Greentown, Illinois. If you read the intro to Fahrenheit 451, he talks about his love of libraries and their influence on him and how that sort of morphed into the writing of that book. If you read the introduction to Martian Chronicles, he talks about his early love affair with Edgar Rice Burroughs and his Mars stories and so on. So he would say that the autobiography is all there, not only in the various forewords and introductions to his books, but also sewn, I would argue, intrinsically into his fiction. I mean, it might surprise a lot of people, but one thing I tried to highlight in the first biography that I wrote of him was that while he's a fantasy writer, his life is deeply embedded into his fantastic fictions. Much of his fantastic fables, if you will, are culled from his own experiences, and then he extrapolates them into the world of the fantastic. I could go through short story by short story, even the ones that take place on Mars, and show you the autobiographical element within those stories, where they came from in his own life experience. So again, he would just tell you that he probably felt it was a little bit redundant to go back and write an autobiography, in that he had written something like Zen and the Art of Writing, which charts sort of his creative life, and then all those introductions, he would argue that it's all there already.
One of those striking situations where he's putting autobiography is where you talk about how one of his affairs morphed into, and I don't remember which story off the top of my head, but how there were elements of an affair, which is obviously very private and private from even his wife, thing that sure. entered into his fiction.
Yeah, that's a story. The affairs come up a few times in his short stories, and you wouldn't know that. I don't think anybody knew that until I illuminated that in that biography, and that was, you know, something that I grappled with a little bit because I was concerned about being sensitive to his wife, who was alive at the time, being sensitive to his children and his grandchildren. I didn't know whether the grandchildren knew about these things. But I also was acutely aware, as a child who read Ray Bradbury, I wanted to be sensitive to the readers, and I didn't want to spoil necessarily an image they may have had about this, you know, almost grandfatherly figure who has led a pretty, very, very positive life and has been an inspiration to so many, and I was very concerned with sort of spoiling that perception. You know, and that story, The Laurel and Hardy Love Affair that you're citing, is in a book called The Toynbee Convector. And ironically, it was a favorite of mine when I was a teenager. I loved that story. And I simply believed it was probably culled more from his relationship with his wife of 56 years than anything else. But the truth is, it was really, you know, culled from an extramarital affair he had in the late 1960s to early 1970s. And that didn't come out until I started working on this biography. But, I mean, that just goes to show you, I mean, I was real committed to telling a fair, balanced, not to sound like Fox News, God forbid, but I wanted to tell a fair, accurately reported narrative of his life, not just this, you know, voluminous puff piece that was written by a fanboy. You know, I'm the first to tell you in the introduction to that book, I am a fan, but this thing is going to tell you the story pretty straight up. And that dictated, in the end, can I tell these stories but still be sensitive to the family and do it with delicately and sensitively. And, I, you know, at the end, I did tell those stories and others that show that Ray Bradbury is very human and is as flawed as anybody else. But when the book came out, I didn't alienate his daughters or his grandchildren or even Ray Bradbury for that matter. They all, his eldest daughter told me at his birthday party over the weekend, I loved your biography. It was beautiful. So I was able to balance that line. I have no idea how that happened. It just worked out that I was able to tell a lot of those stories without hurting anybody.
Did Marguerite's death make the inclusion of those things a little easier, or had you talked with her about those affairs? It sounded like she wasn't fully cognizant of them even many years later.
You are the first person ever to ask me that, you know, and that, you know, I carry a little bit of guilt with that because my book came out in 2005 and she passed away in November of 2003. So I was in the throes of writing it when she passed away and I went to visit her at the hospital with my wife and I never had the opportunity to sit down with her one-on-one and I fully planned on that conversation and was nervous about that conversation. Sitting down with her, I loved her through and through. I went and visited her grave on Saturday and sat and had a conversation with her. You know, she was very good to me. She embraced me and treated me like a son, and she gave no interviews to anybody. She only granted one interview, to the best of my knowledge, during the entirety of their marriage, and it was for an early 90s television documentary. That was it. But she opened up to me constantly. I have hundreds of hours of just conversations with her on tape, and so I fully intended on that conversation saying, I'm including these relationships because I think they're important to understanding his life, and more importantly, to understanding his work and how the experiences informed his canon. And so I intended on that conversation. She knew that I was aware of them. We had talked about them with Ray sitting right there. So she, over the years, had come to know about them. I write about that in the biography. She wasn't obviously happy about it. His argument is really why he did it is articulated in my book of interviews. His sort of stance as to what drove him to extramarital affairs. He would tell you right now, look, it's important for me to emphasize I'm not a womanizer. I never was. I never went out looking for these things. They came to me. I didn't have an affair for 30 years of being faithful. He felt that his wife had sort of emotionally divorced him. And he told all that to me right in front of her. And she disagreed, and they had a very gentle, well, no, you're wrong. And he said, no, I'm not, I'm right. She said, I don't remember ever emotionally divorcing you. I never wanted out. And he said, yes, you did. And they had a gentle argument right in front of me. But to the point of your question, I never had that opportunity to sit down and say, I'm putting this in the book, and I just want you to know that, because she passed away. And so you're saying, you know, did it make it easier? Absolutely, it made it easier. It was a huge relief, but a relief that comes with an immense amount of guilt because I feel like I sneaked one through.
Uh-huh.
But to that level, the kids know it's there, and Ray knows I put it in there, and he had no problem with it. So you're the first person who's ever asked that. You know, and you're getting it. I think the hardest part of writing something this invasive is being sensitive to someone's life.
Uh-huh. You mentioned the disagreement about whether, and I think there's a agreement about whether she actually asked for a legal divorce as well.
Right.
Relying so heavily on Ray Bradbury, and he obviously has very vivid memories, but you point out some situations, I think it's the death of his uncle, and what that happened on Labor Day. And his,
you've read my book closely, geez.
Well, I hadn't had the opportunity to read the whole thing, but I've read some of it. But there's also the bit about remembering being born. How cognizant of you were the, or how worried were you that maybe he's a grand myth maker, a myth of himself, I guess self-mythologizing, versus how much is true?
And I know that's the best questions ever. Yes, the best question. These are the deep philosophical questions I've grappled with as a biographer for 10 years. You know, is the stuff this man is telling me true, or is it the product of a couple things? False memory, which we all have. How on earth do you remember going to a carnival 75 years ago with complete accuracy? So does false memory come into play with what he's telling me? Secondly, this is one of the great American imaginations of the 20th century. When does imagination come into the telling of the tales? And as such, when does it become self-mythology, as you so aptly put it? So that that has constantly been this sort of inner tug of war within my own psyche as a biographer. But at the end of the day, my conclusion, after 10 years of deep immersion in this man's life, I mean, constantly visiting him, constantly going through files, constantly trying to verify his stories through other sources, I've come to the conclusion that more often, far more often than not, this is not mythology. This is the truth. And that if there are inaccuracies coming into play, it's just that he remembered it wrong. You know, to get into something specific that you probably won't use in your article, but the Mr. Electrico story where he remembers the death of the uncle being on the same weekend, and then I find death certificates that shows that he didn't die that weekend. It was a month and a half later. You know, I think he's going back 75 years and combining a couple memories together. I know there was a carnival there that weekend. I know I have the permit for exhibition. So I proved that, yes, the uncle was murdered. Yes, it happened. But I think in that instance, personally, I think he just combined two memories that happened within a month apart 75 or so years ago, or more.
The interesting thing about that is his family remembers it that way too, though.
That shocked me. I mean, the daughter of the uncle, you know, who was murdered, said, no, it was Labor Day weekend. But I'm like, well, I have the newspaper account of the murder, and I have it was a Depression-era holdup on the side of a road in Illinois. I have the newspaper account that shows that it wasn't Labor Day. I have his death certificate, but yet my whole life I was told that it, you know, I recall it going to the funeral on Labor Day weekend. So, you know, I'm flummoxed by that one. I mean, I have too much documentation to show that otherwise. If I found moments where there was mythology, I think I've called it out. Uh-huh. and not necessarily said, you know, these people are making things up, because I don't think he does. I think it's just false memory, and I've endeavored to show occasionally when that's happened to show why. In terms of the birth memory, after 10 years, I believe the guy on that one, totally. It sounds hokey, but I've spent so much time with him that, number one, he remembered his birth around the time his daughter was born. He started having these flashbacks, and he called his mother up and went through the birth detail by detail by detail, and his mother was dumbfounded. How do you know all this? And he said, because I remember it. Now, his argument is like, look, simply, I was a 10-month baby. I was in the womb an extra month before I was born. He arrived late. And his argument is that perhaps his brain had an extra month of development. I don't buy that, because how many people remember anything when they're one or two, for that matter, let alone 10 months rather than nine? So I don't buy that. What I buy is that there's the old sort of scientific theory that has been tossed around that Homo sapiens only use a fraction of their brain capacity, and that people like Einstein use a little bit more. And I think creatively and artistically, Ray Bradbury uses a fraction more of that brain capacity than most of us do. Uh-huh. And he has an immense ability to recall. If you read this new book of interviews, his ability to go back to movies he saw and to tell me what day he saw it, who starred in it, who the extras were as actors, going back to the 30s and 40s. His brain is an encyclopedia, and even at 90, he can still reach back and flip through the pages of that cerebral encyclopedia and call so much up that after all this time, I fully believe that the man remembers elements of his own birth, because I think he's a creative genius.
You wrote that he writes for kids using the tools of the literary masters, and I thought that was really perceptive. When did you come to that epiphany?
Oh, that's a great question. Geez, you're throwing some wonderful things at me here. I think I came to that perception probably that first day I interviewed him, May 2000, and we sat in his living room, and the sunlight was falling in through the windows, and this quote is in my new book. He said, you know, I'm a children's writer, And I said, what? And he said, you know, people don't realize that, but really I'm a children's writer. And so many of the great writers were. And he rattles off people like Nathaniel Hawthorne, you know, and some others, talking about how they are children. They are really, they may not have known it, but they wrote for children. Their ideas were fantastic and memorable and mythological. And at that point, that registered with me that you might be a children's writer, but I knew, having studied his life, that he became a great writer not through studying other genre writers. I think what makes Ray Bradbury very singular is that around, oh, when he was in his early 20s, he really stopped reading the writing of his peers. He stopped reading pulp fiction and science fiction and fantasy, and he started reading Steinbeck, Eudora Welty, Carson McCullers, heavily immersed himself in Ernest Hemingway, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and he started really studying literary writers deeply. And I think, but yet he kept his love of genre. And so I think that's what's made him such a great writer, is that no doubt he's a genre writer, but he brings all the conventions of what he studied in literature over to genre. There aren't that many genre writers, if you think about it, who have been able to accomplish that feat between sort of being tagged a genre writer, but also being labeled a literary writer. There's not a lot of people who have been able to do that. More often than not, genre writers are maligned and sort of put in the gutter of, oh, it's genre fiction. You know, there's genre sections in the bookstore, and then there's fiction and literature. And Bradbury, like someone like Edgar Allan Poe, who was such a huge influence on him, Poe wrote genre fiction, no doubt, some of the classics of horror, but yet there he is in the canon of great literature. And I think Bradbury's been able to do that. So when he said to me, I'm a children's writer, it registered pretty quick in my mind. I'm like, you're a children's writer who brings the conventions of literature to your young adult storytelling. It's a real neat combination.
Does that lead, though, to considering, I guess if we accept the premise that he's a children's writer, I don't know about you, but I stopped reading Ray Bradbury was at, when, you know, college age, basically, and haven't really gone back to him much. Do you think people outgrow him, or do you think they outgrow him?
I think he's a period of Bradbury discovery, teen years, right up until what you said in college, and then you go through a period where you outgrow him. You're right. You're absolutely correct. But yet I think what's remarkable is after 10 years of doing this with him, everybody said, wow, your book has made me go back and want to reread him. So while you might outgrow him for a period, like you do all writers, you immerse yourself in a favorite author, and then it prompts you to move on to something new and discover how other writers handle narrative and telling great stories. And so, yeah, you're right. I think Bradbury is remarkable for young teens, up perhaps through high school, and then they grow and they discover other people. But I think what's really neat about Bradbury is that more often than not, at some point, people return to him. I don't know whether it's a nostalgia, it's a sentimentality for our young readers' lives that we had. There's something really comforting about the books we discovered as children and young adults, and the books that brought us solace and entertainment and philosophy and gave us comfort as readers. There's something wonderful about that. And I think as we grow older, you realize, wow, Ray Bradbury brought all that to me. Maybe I should go back and revisit him. And what's really fascinating about him is that when you do go back and revisit him as an adult reader, you discover an entire new landscape. You discover all those literary things that we just talked about that he was doing in those stories that you may not have been aware of when you were 11. You read them at 11 as these fantastic fables, just like Perseus and Medusa and Prometheus, you know, climbing Mount Olympus. All those stories you read just for entertainment value. But you go back and revisit Bradbury as a grown-up, and you're like, oh my goodness, all the stuff that he must have learned from Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Hawthorne and Melville, a lot of that stuff is there. Deep literary techniques, point of view shifts, you know, adept usage of, you know, first person, third person, even he's told some remarkable stories in the second. He's, you know, a story like There Will Come Soft Rains in the Martian Chronicles. How many examples can you find of literature where there's not a single human being in the story? There's not a single person in that whole story. It's a mechanized house going through its daily ritual as with nobody there to witness it any longer because they've all been annihilated by nuclear war. So he wrote an entire story without a person in it. And people often laugh and say, well, Disney movies do that with animals. But there's no Bambi or Dumbo in this thing either. I mean, the guy was very experimental and cutting edge on a literary level. So I think revisiting Bradbury as a grown-up, quote-unquote, is a remarkable experience. It's so exhilarating because you not only reconnect with your inner child as reader, but you discover a whole new horizon of literary technique in his work. It's remarkable to go back. And the one thing I've heard more than any with my books coming out is, thank you for making me want to go back and reread Ray Bradbury. I've heard that for 10 years. Well, for 5 since my biography came out. And that's been wonderful. I mean, I feel like I did my job. I've made people interested in him again.
Are your college audiences, your students, are they surprised by what they discover in the class?
They really are, because we, you know, in my department, it's a creative writing department, so we teach writers how to read like writers. How do good writers get stories on the page? And I think they do. They come in thinking sci-fi, scribe, you know, fantasy man, you know. When they see some of the very same techniques on the page that a writer like Hemingway would use or Salinger or Toni Morrison, and they see some of those same techniques that Bradbury's employing, they're like, this is some deep writing. There's not only on one level, I think they're stunned at the lyrical quality of his prose. I think by and large, they walk away and they say, the language is gorgeous. He's, you know, Aldous Huxley, the great writer, told Ray Bradbury, the one thing you are more than anything else is a poet. There's deep poetry in your language. And my students are very surprised at the lyricism, but they're also surprised at the technique, and that's very gratifying to me, because I steadfastly believe that this is one of our great literary writers. And as time marches on, he's going to be recognized as such, and he already is. I mean, he's in the Norton Anthology of Short Fiction, and you know, Fahrenheit 451 was the 9th best-selling classic last year on the same list that includes To Kill a Mockingbird and Great Gatsby and 1984. So, I mean, he's entered the pantheon of world literature. He's been canonized, but I think people still see him as the genre scribe. And so they are surprised, very pleasantly surprised at the depth of his work.
Not much of a reviser, was he?
Yeah, that's a good question.
The thing that I recall and the thing that always strikes me about Bradbury's prose is its enthusiasm, and I think that that's a function of the process, but. It doesn't sound like from your book that there's a whole lot more than slightly revised first drafts going on, even in the novel cases, some cases.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's the way he perceives it and he remembers it. You know, I would say in my book, I call him out a little bit on that. I think in the early days, particularly when he was working on his first book of short stories, he was very particular. He's a lightning fast first draft writer. He believes completely in trusting the subconscious and your inner storyteller, that we're all storytellers at heart. We all have the ability to tell a tale, And so he trusts that, and just sort, he would say, I throw up in the morning and I clean it up in the afternoon. And so his first drafts are always very fast. A story like The Veldt, he wrote in 2 hours, which is a classic. Fahrenheit 451, which you mentioned, he wrote in 9 days. But the revision component of his career is much more murky. He claims that a revision is really cutting. We tend to write, we tend to be a little bit too long-winded in first drafts, and that revision is mostly cutting, is what he says, and polishing. But I my research and looking into his letters and manuscripts shows that there's a bit more to it in his early career when he was writing so many of the classics. There was a bit more hard labor in his revision stages than he cares to remember. He doesn't like the revision stages. It can become work for him, and he doesn't believe that writing should ever be work. But I would say in his 20s and 30s, which is so much is considered his golden era, he put some hard labor in the revision stages. And what's fascinating to me is that some things he's continued to revise even after they've been published. They're short stories that he's changed and altered in different publications because something bugged him. I could cite you specific examples, but it might be too much. So that's an area where I think he has a little false memory going on. I think he put more blood, sweat, and tears into revising than he cares to recall because I think it was traumatic.
Which 5 stories do you challenge high school students with?
Oh, God, you're good. They vary a little bit depending on the demographic. If I go around high schools constantly and talk to students about why Ray Bradbury matters to their generation, why they should care, what makes him fantastic, and I end usually with my talk with 5 short stories that I challenge them all to rush out and read because I think on the surface, as we talked about earlier, for teen readers, they're just great stories. They're engaging, they're fun, they're entertaining, they're scary, they're wildly imaginative. So I alter it a little depending on where I am, the socioeconomic level perhaps of the group or stories that I think might connect more to where they're at in their life or geographically. But generally, here's the stories that I would put out. I always throw on The Lake, which is in the October Country. It's also in a great collection called The Stories of Ray Bradbury, which was just reissued by Everyman's Library.
I believe I have that one. That's from like 1980.
Great book. Yep, great book. Great book. You cannot do wrong by getting that book, that single book. So it's called The Lake. He wrote it when he was 22 years old, and he would tell you that it's the first great story he ever wrote. He discovered his voice with that story. Everything we know that is singularly Bradbarian is in that story, the lyrical language, the sense of melancholy, the presiding majesty of autumn, which is, he owns, in my book, October and autumn. And so The Lake is a beautiful, melancholy, sweet ghost story. So here's an example of him taking an experience that he had as a child and reimagining it as a ghost story. If you want me to articulate further, I will. But so the first one is The Lake. The next one is All Summer in a Day, which is often assigned in middle schools, about a little girl on Venus.
The one who gets locked in the closet?
You got it.
Yep, I
got it. Great story. That's also in The Stories of Ray Bradbury. You're catching me here. I would say the next one would be The Sound of Summer Running. It's about the tennis shoe story. It's in Dandelion Wine. It's about the majesty of a new pair of sneakers to a child at the beginning of summer. What it means to go out and get a brand new pair of tennis shoes. It's just a great, simple, beautiful story. So that's 3. I would read The Foghorn absolutely positively. Ray would tell you that that's one of his favorite stories of his own. It's about a dinosaur who lives at the bottom of the ocean. It's the last dinosaur on Earth, and it hears the sad call of a lighthouse foghorn, and the creature rises from the depths, thinking that maybe that bellow, that moan, is the call of its long-lost mate. And it rises to the surface only to discover this structure and to find out that it is indeed alone. It's a story about unrequited love, about loneliness, all through the prism and point of view of a dinosaur. It's fantastic. It has a passage in there that is as good as anything that Ray Bradbury has ever written. It's about the origins of the sound of a foghorn. It's a beautiful paragraph in there. And it's that John Huston, the film director, read that single story, and that's what prompted him to call Ray Bradbury and ask him to come to Ireland and write the screenplay to Moby Dick, which came out in 1956 and starred Gregory Peck as Captain Ahab. So is that four or five?
That's four.
That's four. The last one I would read is The Veldt, which I think it's the lead story in The Illustrated Man. If I'm not mistaken, all of these tales can be found in the stories of Ray Bradbury. That story, have you ever read it?
Yes, read it in junior high school.
There you go. I mean, this is all, here you go at the children's writer thing. All these stories are about, mostly, all of them except The Veldt are about children.
Uh-huh.
Or, I mean, all these stories about, except The Foghorn are include children in them or are about children. The Veldt is scary. It's Bradbury. I think it's the great short story lead-up in many ways to what he was attempting to ruminate on in Fahrenheit 451. In that, he was talking about the misuse of technology and the mishandling of television in particular. It's about a virtual reality playroom for children in the future and how parents over-rely on it as sort of a babysitter for their kids, and then they realize that the kids have become addicted to it, and it's too late when they try to take the children away from this technology. The children get very angry. It's this great cautionary tale. Bradbury is one of his calling cards is the cautionary tale, the fictive warning, if you will, where he cautions all of us about, okay, this is taking over, but be careful, because in the wrong hands, this technology, be it television or colonization of another planet or what have you, in the wrong hands, mishandled, it becomes a very dangerous thing. So those are the five stories I often assign. And then I tell kids, you know, contact me on Facebook, contact me on Twitter, trying to use social networking, or contact me on MySpace and let me know what you think of these stories. And you know, more often than not, I hear back from kids. They don't usually read all five, but they usually read one or two. And it's remarkable that I was able to challenge somebody to go to read a short story. They read it. They recontacted me. They tell me what they thought of it. My hope is that they fall in love with the work of Bradbury and it prompts them to read more.
Mm-hmm. You're starting your 25 Essential Bradbury Stories. You started that with The Veldt, right?
I did. Yeah, I'm locked and loaded on the next one.
Do you know?
On my website.
Do you know all 25?
I'm making it up as I go along, but yeah, I pretty much know all 25. You could argue, anybody could go and argue and say, you missed one, and I will miss one for sure, but these are 25 that I always assign in my class. They're always there. I see the response that students have to them. I could rattle all 25 off right now for sure.
Thank you. When you're here, you're going to be talking about Fahrenheit 451 specifically, or about Bradbury generally?
It's sort of a two-part presentation. It's I always call it the man behind the masterpiece. So it's a presentation on the life of Ray Bradbury, some personal anecdotes about my relationship with him. I think really some surprising anecdotes on his contributions to popular culture and how important he is. And then I get into, perhaps his most important contribution being Fahrenheit 451, which is recognized as by many as his masterpiece, and I get into a real sort of behind the scenes discussion, the sort of, you know, the making of Fahrenheit 451, how it came to fruition, its autobiographical connections to his own life, why he wrote it, what he was endeavoring to do, the history of the book itself, the writing of it, the publication of it, the fact that it's also been censored. It's on many, you know, banned book lists, and the history of that, and sort of its future. So it's really sort of a, you know, I think a pretty energetic hour of, you know, behind-the-scenes story on the man behind the masterpiece and then the masterpiece itself.
Mm-hmm. Is Fahrenheit 451 characteristic? We've talked quite a bit about what is Bradbury, and Fahrenheit 451 seems a little almost outside of that in some ways.
Absolutely. It's not characteristic, I don't think. I mean, you know, as you said earlier, you know, he talks about the five Ladyfinger firecrackers. Certainly, there are short stories that would fall into that same sort of milieu, if you will, you know, sort of the dystopian fantasy in the vein of Huxley or Orwell. There are short stories that, where he's done that, but I don't think it's indicative of his larger, what's that French word, is oeuvre.
You
know, it's not indicative of his the entirety of everything he's created. I think it's more singular. He would tell you, and I'm sure you've read him in an interview where he says that Fahrenheit 451 is really the only book of science fiction he's ever written.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people are surprised by that. Well, The Martian Chronicles has rocket ships and set on Mars. Isn't that science fiction? And he would say that, no, it's fantasy, because his definition is science fiction is the art of the possible. It's something that could come true, possibly, and fantasy is the art of the impossible. And so Martian Chronicles is obviously impossible because there are Martians there. There's an atmosphere on the planet. The hills are blue, and so it's a fantasy set on the world of Mars. Whereas Fahrenheit 451, he would say, is pure science fiction. I would classify it more as social satire. I think it uses the prism of science fiction, but more than anything, it's an examination of contemporary society, written, you know, in 1953. So it was an examination of post World War II America, in particular. But what's remarkable about it is, while it may have been a response to, you know, the post World War II era, it's connected in a very magnificent way to every subsequent generation thereafter. The boomers claimed it theirs, but so did, you know, readers during the Vietnam era, and then Gen X, and now Gen Y. It has a way that I think all good literature does that allows it to remain timeless. That's one of the things I think that makes great literature literature, in that there's a timeless quality to it. Regardless of the era it's written, it has these elements of universal truths, and Fahrenheit 451 is loaded with them. Truths about Big Brother, truths about the proliferation of mass media, and particularly sort of the looming threat of television and how it could and will contribute to the dumbing down of society. You know, it's visionary on so many different levels. It also gets at the power of the individual, how one person does indeed still have the power to rise up and make a difference, and institute some change, perhaps. There's so many sort of timeless truths embedded in this, and I think that's what's contributed to its longevity.
What are the key differences between the first version of the book, the one that was the half-length version, essentially, and the finished product?
Oh, the first version was published in Galaxy magazine, which was just a digest-sized pulp fiction magazine, science fiction magazine, in February of 1951, and it was called The Fireman, and it had Guy Montag in it. You know, it had many of the same characters. It's very similar. It's a dystopian society where books have been banished and firemen set about to burn those that still remain. In many ways, it is Fahrenheit 451, but it was only 25,000 words long. And Fahrenheit 451 is 50,000 words. So it set up the novel. It has the same characters, basically, some of whom have different names, but they're the same principal players. It's the same society. But yet Bradbury went back in 1953 at the request of Ian Ballantyne, the publisher who started Ballantyne Books, came to Bradbury and said, you know, this novella that you've published has remarkable potential as a novel. Could you add to it? And so Bradbury went back and doubled it. What I find fascinating is he didn't really use the original 25,000 words that much. He really rewrote the entire thing and used the original novella as a reference point. But, you know, while many writers would just tag on 25,000 more words to what has existed to complete it, he rewrote the whole thing. So thematically and aesthetically, it's much the same. It's just much longer and rewritten, and I think it's rewritten much more beautifully. The language is richer. I think the prescience, if that's the right word, is more salient and profound in what he was able to predict and envision and all the technologies. It's a much better work, but it wouldn't have happened without the fireman coming out in sort of a, you know, an off-the-radar screen, if you will, digest science fiction magazine that a lot of people have never even heard of. And I think props need to be given to Ballantyne for looking at that novella and saying, this has the potential to be a great, great novel.
Bradbury is primarily known as a short story writer, and he really, until the 80s, didn't seem to be that interested in the novel outside of a way to collect stories in some ways. What, and I know that's not true with Something Wicked This Way Comes, but there aren't, but Fahrenheit 451 kind of stands out. What is he able to do in that book that maybe he wasn't able to do in short stories, or what does the luxury of length bring to the work?
Wow. Terrific question. You're absolutely correct. I mean, I think Bradbury would tell you, his wife told me, I mean, his strongest medium as a storyteller is the short story. You know, whether it's he's written in film and poetry and essays and novels, and short stories and theatrical plays and what have you, make no mistake that his strength is the short story. That said, it's interesting that Fahrenheit is widely recognized as his masterwork. You're right in that he used, you know, many of the so-called novels were just tapestries of short stories sewn together, as he would say, disguised, short story collections disguised as a novel. But Fahrenheit is a standalone novel, as is something like Something Wicked This Way Comes. I think what the book allowed him to do, you know, more from a scholarly vantage point, is to, there's a lot more character exploration, I think, that is afforded because of the length. You can't, you know, Harold Bloom, the renowned literary scholar, I interviewed him in the course of doing my biography, and he said that Bradbury is an idea man, first and foremost. His stories are based on ideas. He's not a character writer. That was Bloom's point of view on it. And that he also is from the tradition of the Romantics. You know, Keats and Wordsworth, there's a romantic quality to Bradbury's work. I agree with that. Bloom felt that many of Bradbury's characters were sort of flat to the page, that the ideas were larger than the characters themselves. I think that Fahrenheit 451 allows him really to examine characters at length. The length of the book afforded him the opportunity to examine characters, and I think as a result, Clarice is one of the strongest characters in the entirety of his output. She's a remarkable, precocious, catalytic character who is the instrument of change in Guy Montag's world. Guy Montag, if you look at him, it has a lot of backstory to him that we don't really know about, but he's a very deep and conflicted individual. And that confliction is at the nucleus of the book, and how he at one point is a passionate book burner and begins to inquire why people are so vested in reading and so connected to these objects, and starts to inquire on his own. And so we follow through and follow his confliction. Captain Beatty as well, who's this great protagonist, I think follows the grand tradition of, I should have said an antagonist. He follows the grand tradition of the greatest villains have sympathetic qualities to them. The greatest villains are multidimensional. And that Captain Beatty, while is the leader in the book in terms of book burnings, he is the he's obviously read books himself. He obviously has a deep literary background. How does he know all this stuff that he's talking about? How does he know the history of literature? And so there's such an opportunity in the 50,000 word novel that he didn't have initially to examine these characters. And I think as a result, they're some of the most wonderful characters he's ever had in any of his works. I mean, from the complexity of Montag's wife, Mildred, who I think on the surface could just be looked at as kind of a nag and, you know, a symbol of the dumbed down society who's addicted to pills and to television. There's moments of sympathy in her and sorrow and melancholy in her. I think each one of the lead characters in 451 are remarkably fleshed out.
Does Fahrenheit 451 make you wish Ray Bradbury had a longer attention span back in his prime?
I ask him flat out if he thinks he has attention deficit disorder because of his inclination to write the short story. And he said, you know, I never thought of it that way, but yeah, I suppose it's true. I've made a deficiency a strength, and that he likes to read the short story over the novel, absolutely positively. Anytime I've asked him about writers, what do you think of William Faulkner? Well, I like his short stories more than his novel. Hemingway, short stories over the novel. Fitzgerald, you know, blah, blah, blah. He reads the short story and he writes the short story, and I think you're right. There's an attention span thing going on there. But no, it doesn't make me yearn for more longer material, because I love his short stories, and I think he did a marvelous job. People often ask me what my favorite book is, and it varies, but at the very top of that list is Dandelion Wine, which goes back to what you categorized earlier as sort of that short story collection that's parading as a novel, and I love that book deeply. So, you know, it's a complicated question. Ray would say he wouldn't change anything about his life. He wouldn't do anything different. I would say my only hope is that the man has a little bit more time on this earth to continue to create, because the mind is still full of remarkable ideas.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, the concept that begins the book, the idea of book burning, is in a way outdated, in the sense that it's impossible to destroy something that exists in the world right now with the internet, pretty much.
Yeah.
Could you kind of explain how you think Fahrenheit 451 is still relevant in spite of, you know, book burning being not really a practical method of censorship?
Yeah, I think book burning, as most of Bradbury's works, is just a metaphor for, you know, everything Bradbury writes, he would tell you, is a metaphor for a human truth, you know, whether we're going to Mars in an old rocket ship. That's a metaphor for, you know, humanity taking its problems to a new land. So book burning is simply just a symbol for something larger, and whether that's the destruction of libraries, the demise of education in our society, he would tell you again that censorship can be defined in many ways. And so book burning is a metaphor for all of that. You know, he's got a very famous quote that's out there that he said years ago, that and I paraphrase it, but you don't need to burn a book to censor it. All you need to do is get people to stop reading. And so book burning is really not the point. That's just a device, an exciting device that I would say he stole from his experiences of watching the Nazis burn books during World War II. That's where he got it. Coupled with knowing full well that throughout history, there have been incidents of famous libraries being destroyed, most notably the Alexandrian libraries of ancient times. So he knew that book destruction has been something that has been a part of humanity for centuries. But I think he just used it as a device to examine self-censorship, willfully dumbing ourselves down, willfully not challenging ourselves philosophically, willfully accepting what we're told to do, what we're told to believe. So there's lots of ways to burn knowledge, and it doesn't necessarily need to involve kerosene and a match.
You mentioned the Nazis, and I'm interested in your take on his comment. I think it was in one of the introductions to Fahrenheit 451, equating book burning with the Holocaust. And I was wondering if you were aware if he ever caught any crap for that.
God, that's a great question. God, you ask really great questions. Yeah, I don't, to the best of my knowledge, he never caught any crap for it, but damn, that's a really incendiary, if you will, quote that he wrote in there about where he says, "Forgive me if you will, but, you know, I was as distraught by the burning of a book as, you know, the destruction of a human."
Well, I think what he says is that they're one and the same.
Right.
And I'm just curious, can you abide by that? Have you talked with him about that?
I have talked with him about it because he feels that, you know, if you look at his own response, goes back to Mr. Electrico, his own response to immortality is through the creations we leave behind, be them our children and offspring, our grandchildren, or as writers, the documentation of our philosophies, ideas, and visions. And that our creations are one of our ways towards seeking immortality and our ability to live forever. So a writer in particular who leaves a book behind in many ways lives forever because their most interpersonal thoughts are there and documented between two covers. So when that book is burned, so too is the soul of the individual who created it. So the person is destroyed yet again. Their most important remnant of their life and their existence is what they had created. And when that book is destroyed, their spirit is destroyed along with it. That's what he's getting at. So the very soul of the person who created that is now reduced to cinders.
We talked a little about kind of the relevance of the book today. How do college students find Fahrenheit 451 relevant to them, or how do they articulate the themes in terms of their own lives?
You know, more often than not, the surface response is they're amazed at the prescience of the author to envision things like seashell radios that are awfully similar to earbuds on iPods. They're amazed at all the technological prognostication that Bradbury set forth in the book, when in fact he's often been deemed a Luddite. You know, he's never driven a car. He didn't fly on an airplane until he was 62. He has never owned and operated a computer. And so I think a lot of college-age readers, because this is such a technological generation too, from tweeting to following people on Facebook to their websites and their blogs and their texts. What is it? A statistic came out that 97% of college students favor text messaging as their favorite form of communication. I mean, over talking. And so I think the technological visions laid out in the book, I think, amaze college-age readers. How on earth did this 33-year-old man predict all of this stuff? And his response is, I have no idea. You know, he wrote the book in 9 days and just used his fanciful imagination and pondered what the future could bring and wrote it. But I think the college generation marvel less at the Big Brother aspect of the book, which Bradbury himself downplays. You know, he would tell you that the Big Brother aspect is really not the point of the book. People are policing themselves now in the book. Go ahead.
Do your students recognize that, in terms of the idea of a mediated isolation, that he's talking about them?
Yeah, very much so. I think that's the nature of Bradbury, is that he's very good at using the prism of the fantastic to actually serve as a mirror for ourselves. And, you know, I think I'm really fortunate. You know, I'm bragging here about the students in my college, but I've got a really good crop of students semester in and semester out. I mean, this is a very diverse school. There's 13,000 people here. They come from all walks of humanity, you know, from the very, very rich kid who grew up in a giant McMansion to kids who have grown up in housing projects. And it's a really remarkable spectrum of students. And they're very creative. And to their credit, they recognize that Bradbury is writing about them immediately. And that's another reason that I think there's the timeless quality to this to this book. The timeless nature is that, gosh, more people tell me this book is more powerful now than it's ever been. It's almost more relevant today than it was in the 50s.
That leads to the question of, does it change behavior, though? And if it doesn't change behavior, what's its value? I mean, I guess there's a certain value to self-knowledge that, yes, I've isolated myself with my iPod and my iPhone and texting rather than talking to people, but if you don't change something,
yeah,
what impact has it really had?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'd be lying if I said the students read Fahrenheit 451 and they opt to put their cell phone down and they stop. They realize that they're staring more at a screen than they are into people's eyes. I'd be kidding you if that was the truth. I think, you know, but the power, certainly we all hope that the power of a great creative act, be it a film or a novel or a play, is an instrument of some sort of change. I don't think there's any higher calling than that when you create something and it can serve as an instrument of change. But that's pretty few and far between, where a movie or a television show, for that matter, or a graphic novel or a play actually instrumented, you know, some sort of title shift culturally. I think more often than not, it causes us to ponder our existence, and I think Fahrenheit 451 certainly does. I've had many discussions in my classes where students are like, man, you know, he's got it here. You know, we as a society aren't reading the newspaper anymore. Everything has been condensed down to a digest or a pie graph, down a la USA Today. Everything is lightning fast. Everything is, you know, what download speed can I have? And the concept of the porch conversation late at night, or the curling up with a novel for a long, enjoyable read, you know, that's vanishing. And I think students recognize it, but to be totally honest with you, I don't think it's causing them to turn their phones off. I wish.
Did Bradbury recognize, does he recognize an irony kind of between his own lifestyle? I know, sitting in front of the TV with his wife in the afternoons and you know, kind of the social problems he points out at Fahrenheit 451?
God, you know, it's remarkable. Again, you're really asking great questions. I don't think he sees the magnitude of the irony, or the uncanny quality of it. I've brought it up to him many, many times. You know, as mentioned, we beamed him into a bookstore in Manhattan a month ago, and there he is on a flat panel, large screen TV. And, you know, I think all the people in the audience recognized, so sort of the contradictory nature of here he's talking about warning us on the looming threat of this technology and how it could contribute to the degradation of intellectual culture, and yet we're utilizing that very technology to discuss his works and his life. I don't think he giggles when I mention it, but I don't think he spends a lot of time connecting the dots on it. And I think a lot of that is he doesn't spend a lot of time connecting the dots, particularly when it comes to cell phone technology or the internet in particular. He's not a big fan of the internet. He thinks it's just a huge waste of our time. You know, I mean, I've tried to show him how it can serve as a research tool, obviously, and it's a digital library that equalizes a playing field for anybody who has access to a computer at a public library. And he sees the relevance in it, but he sees it too much as a danger of internet surfing distraction. You know, for every person doing research, there's, you know, hundreds out there spending mindless hours looking at nothingness, in his opinion. And so he thinks it's just yet one more device that would fit into Fahrenheit 451. The internet would, in his estimation, would fit beautifully into the novel as one of the technological components that's making us all stupid.
Did he, because he's continued to work almost daily, does he kind of see his own habits as from TV to drinking as irrelevant because he still has an intellectual life?
No, he would say that, look, I'm not against all TV. I'm just against bad TV. He's not against people going to the movie theater, obviously, or spending time watching the television or reading comic books. There's a shot in Fahrenheit 451 where it said, everything, books have been reduced to comic book form. Well, he's done that to his own work.
And Fahrenheit 451, including Fahrenheit 451.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a contradictory nature to it, but he would say, look, I'm not against comic books and graphic novels. For God's sakes, they were a huge influence on my life. I'm not against TV. He's written for television and has 12 Cable Ace Awards to show for it and an Emmy Award. He wrote for The Twilight Zone and for Hitchcock. A lot of people said, you're a great hypocrite. You're writing for television as you're lambasting the technology. He would say, look, I'm not against all of this stuff, but just in moderation, and also gravitate towards something that is intellectually challenging, as opposed to stupid. He just feels that we're too quick as a society to gravitate towards the stupidity value in our entertainment.
You allude to an incident in your introduction talking about his use of profanity or spare use of profanity. Mm-hmm. What interpretation in the college class caused him to tell them to fuck off?
Oh, you know, he couldn't remember, to be honest with you, and I tried to track that professor down. I think from his recollection it was that it was Fahrenheit 451 was more of a Big Brother indictment, and that this is about government control, and they were insistent upon that, and he's been pretty clear all along that while it was a response to Hitler, no doubt, it was a response to Stalin, no doubt, it was a response to McCarthy, no doubt. More than anything, it was a response to the rise of mass media and how that would overtake intellectual culture and would sort of hypnotize us into a stupor. And the students, from what he could recall, but he wasn't really sure, he was a little vague on it, but the students were interpreting it much more of an indictment of Big Brother.
How does Fahrenheit 451 fit in with, say, 1984 and Brave New World, kind of the, I think, the classic trilogy of dystopia? Do you think it belongs with those? Do you think there are key differences among them?
I do think it belongs with those books. And, you know, most people in my travels, you know, and you just, I think the very nature that you asked the question shows that it's in the triumvirate, if the word is correct, that's part of that. But I don't think Fahrenheit 451, and I'm no expert on Huxley or Orwell, but I don't think that Fahrenheit is as hopeless, personally. I think what's beautiful about Bradbury is while he writes some pretty dark tales, there's always an element of the potential for salvation within all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a positive quality to Bradbury that's not just so damn morose. And I think, this might be a blasphemous and also controversial comment, but I think part of the reason that Bradbury's been shunned often by the literary establishment over the years is that there is an element of positivity and hopefulness at the core of even his darkest works. And so much of literature is quite destitute and fucking depressing, and I don't knock it. I love F. Scott Fitzgerald, and so many others, but I think the positivity of Bradbury, I think, has bit him in the butt sometimes. I think the New York establishment looked at him a little too hopeful, a little too enthusiastic, a little too effusive, filled with too much optimism.
And too many exclamation points.
Completely. Absolutely.
The one example that I think of immediately is Michael Chabon, but could you list off some people you think probably wouldn't be where they are in the world without Ray Bradbury?
Oh, my God.
And I know you do this in your biography by essentially with the epigraphs at the beginning of a lot of the chapters. But
yeah, I mean, I'm working on a project that I can't really talk about. I wish I could, but I'm kind of tied in with a publisher and an agent, and they won't let me discuss it yet. But it gets at that very nature of Ray Bradbury's sort of literary influence. Michael Chabon has professed his love, but, Stephen King said there is no Stephen King without Ray Bradbury. As a result, Joe Hill, who is Stephen King's son and is a New York Times bestselling writer himself, remarkable writer, and in many ways, he's only written, I think, 3 books, but his collection of short stories, it's called 20th Century Ghosts, shows that I think Joe Hill could well be the heir, kind of the new gatekeeper to October Country if he continues on that path. Along with that, there was an Oprah book club author named Alice Hoffman, who's written many novels, who has professed her undying affection and credited Bradbury's great inspiration on her career. Harlan Ellison, who's considered one of the great horror writers of the 20th century, huge Bradbury fan, huge influence. Richard Matheson, another great fantasy writer. Charles Beaumont, who was the chief writer of The Twilight Zone, wrote the greatest episodes of The Twilight Zone and was a remarkable writer, was one of Ray Bradbury's students in the early 1950s. Bradbury really coached him on the art of the short story. Neil Gaiman wrote an essay. Of course, he won the Newbery Award last year for this book called The Graveyard Book. He's a rock star amongst younger readers today, and he wrote an essay in The Times in London 2 months ago talking about his love for Ray Bradbury and how influential Bradbury was on him as a writer. Ray read that essay and cried, couldn't believe it. Continue down the list. I mean, in my book, I also show that it's not just writers. I mean, I could list off many rock musicians who he's really been influential on and how that his storytelling has infiltrated their music. Elton John wrote The Rocket Man with his collaborator Bernie Taupin, named for the story in The Illustrated Man, Rocket Man. So that very famous Elton John single is because of a Bradbury story. David Bowie, during the Ziggy Stardust era, asked to have dinner with Ray Bradbury, and they went out. And Bradbury and Bowie hit it off, and Bowie professed his love and affection. I mean, there's many, many musicians, and it's part of the reason I tapped a musician to write the foreword of my new book, which is Black Francis, who founded this band, the Pixies.
Right.
Really influential alternative rock band that a lot of people may not be a household name, but most musicians would tell you this is one of the most influential bands of the 80s and 90s.
There is no Nirvana without Pixies.
You know your stuff, man. I gotta hang out with you more often. There's no, you're right. And he did a solo album called The Cult of Ray for Ray Bradbury. So there's the literary influence, which is sizable. It's just tremendous. And what's really neat is it really extends outside of genre. Audrey Niffeniger, who wrote The Time Traveler's Wife, is a colleague of mine here at Columbia, and she loves Bradbury. I mean, it's just it's so wide sweeping. Steven Spielberg, there's the film directors.
Uh-huh.
It's really quite incredible, and I think it gets at the power of his storytelling abilities.
And Close Encounters is very much a Ray Bradbury. I mean, it has the awe and wonder of Ray Bradbury, it seems.
You're absolutely correct. And in the new book I just released, I asked him, you know, what's your favorite science fiction film? And he said Close Encounters is the greatest science fiction film ever made. So you pegged it. And you're right. It's because it's the awe. I think it also has the a spiritual component to it. You know, Bradbury deemed it, it's God's finger in the Da Vinci, you know, masterwork, God's finger coming down to touch humanity. And in this instance, God's hand is the UFO. He would say that it's a science fictional retelling of a Da Vinci masterwork. And so much of Bradbury is steeped in sort of biblical allegory or parables, despite the fact that, you know, Bradbury doesn't deem himself a Christian. I mean, he's a universalist when it comes to his religion. He abides by tenets of Buddhism and Christianity and other faiths. I think you're right. I mean, Close Encounters has this grand spiritual component to it, and I think a lot of Bradbury stuff has that as well.
He's also led a kind of a curiously, I'm just going to use just throw out the name just because it'll say what I'm saying. I mean, he's had there's a Forrest Gump quality to his life. He's been, it's not just that he's, you know, it's Walt Disney, it's John Huston, it's Francois Truffaut. I mean, down through the line, and one of my favorite critics, Stanley Kaufman, you know, was his editor for Fahrenheit 451. I mean, it's just he's had a very strange, large, and big name assemblage around him for his entire life, almost, it seems.
God, you're right. I've never heard anybody call it Forrest Gump, and it's right on the money. It almost seems impossible when you think of Forrest Gump, you know, and all the encounters. It almost seems too good to be true, but yet here are all the pictures of, you know, 14-year-old Ray Bradbury standing alongside George Burns and Marlene Dietrich and, you know, standing outside Grauman's Chinese Theater and seeing Shirley Temple put her hands in cement, and then traveling to Ireland with John Huston and taking Rod Serling to his basement to pile books of Poe and Roald Dahl in his arms, and then lunching with Hitchcock and going to Hitchcock's home in the Hollywood Hills, and, you know, sitting at a card table in Walt Disney's office and having deli sandwiches and talking about their love and affection for World's Fairs, and then having directors like Sam Peckinpah and Steven Spielberg, you know, write love letters to him, and on and on and on. How on earth is this possible? You're right. It's Forrest Gump.
Living to age 90 as well, I think, helps.
That's a big part of it. When you live that long, he's seen, you know, some of these relationships come full circle. In my new book, I ask him, okay, you met George Burns when you were 14. Did you ever encounter him again? And he did. You know, later in life, after he became the Ray Bradbury that everybody knows, he encountered George Burns, and George Burns remembered him. I remember you as a kid. You were precocious. You were pushy. You were amazing. So, yeah, you're right. It's how many people have the gift to witness their own legend? And he, you know, his lifespan has afforded that.
You make a mention in the book of saying that he looked at a six-pack of Coors went down like water, and you mentioned, and this is purely for my own curiosity, there was that you mentioned the televised documentary in the early 90s, and I remember, I'm guessing I saw the same one.
Yeah.
He's standing in his kitchen, and on the counter there are about 30 cans of Coors.
There's a bunch of empties.
Is that, I mean, was a six-pack, were you being gentle in saying a six-pack, or
was... I think I was being gentle, yeah. I mean, I didn't know him in 1992 when that documentary was being made, but his wife told me flat out that he was a full-blown alcoholic. And I asked him, I said, look, Ray, Maggie told me you were an alcoholic. What's your response to that? And he said, this bullshit. You know, he said, an alcoholic, you know, he gets in the way. He said, you know, look at my productivity through the period that Maggie claimed I'm an alcoholic, and look what I was doing, you know. And at the same year, he was piling high the counter with empties. He released Green Shadows, White Whale, a remarkable, really, really powerful book that people don't often mention about going to Ireland and writing Moby Dick. He wrote quite a few good works during that period when he was drinking hard. He was a hard drinker, no doubt. I didn't witness the level of it, but he was drinking hard. And the first day I interviewed him, he said the reason I had a stroke was because I was not eating well and I was drinking way too much. So I was being gentle with a six pack. He told me that he was doing a 12 pack a day.
So that's kind of what I guess, but it could just be he hadn't picked up the recycling yet. I just curious. How do you think his you mentioned that people don't talk about his later work much. Mm-hmm. Among his later works, what do you think is most overlooked? I mean, I remember reading Death is a Lonely Business and sort of laughing at the kind of the joke, which, if I recall correctly, if he hadn't had a stuffy nose, he would have solved the mystery right at the outset, I think. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't look at the later stuff.
When you're the Beatles and you record, you know, the White Album and Revolver and Sgt. Pepper's and Let It Be and Magical Mystery Tour in all of whatever, 4 or 5 years, and then Paul McCartney and John Lennon go off and release, and Harrison, they go off and release remarkable solo material, but it's forever going to be eclipsed by the majesty of that 4-year, 5-year period of time, where these masterworks were shot out with precision and prolificacy. Bradbury, I think it's similar. From 1950 to 1962, look at what he did. It's the same sort of Beatles analogy: Illustrated Man, Martian Chronicles, Golden Apples of the Sun, Fahrenheit 451, The October Country, Something Wicked This Way Comes, Dandelion Wine. I mean, in 12 years, and I'm not even naming all of them, not to mention the television work and the film work. So he had this golden period of just sheer mad brilliance and output. And so later in life, the output wasn't as regular, I think, largely because he was on a lecture circuit and making a lot of money. And secondly, I think he was distracted heavily by theater and had a theater company in L.A. So local Bradbury fans in L.A. could enjoy his work, but yet the world might not have known it was happening. So the output didn't appear as great, even though he was working regularly, just in perhaps less noticeable media. But nonetheless, there are absolute gems, objectively. I mean, looking at it, you know, I'm not necessarily a fan of everything the man has ever written. You know, I'm not saying everything the man has written is brilliant. He's had works that weren't as successful as others, like every writer. But there are absolute gems later in life, and it's nice of you to even bring those up. I mean, Death is a Lonely Business, I think, is a remarkable sort of noir detective story. It's incredibly evocative of old Venice, California. It has the hallmarks, again, of Bradbury's lyrical language. I think it's a taut novel. Green Shadows, White Whale captures Ireland in a magical, magical, poetic, beautiful way, and it's semi-autobiographical, very autobiographical, really. Again, there's kind of a memoir that's called a novel about a young writer going to Ireland and writing a screenplay for a crazy, egomaniacal film director. Another book that is always overlooked that's incredible is The Toynbee Convector, which is a short story collection that came out in the late 1980s.
It's like 87, 88?
Yeah. So forgive me if I can't give you the exact. It's 87 or 88.
I've got a copy of it, so.
Great book. I mean, the Laurel and Hardy love affair is in there, but there are other short stories in there that are absolute classic Bradbury tales. So he has still hit it over the last quarter century with some remarkable releases.
Anything since his stroke? I'm guessing age and stroke have diminished him to some degree. Is there anything he's written in the past, decade plus that you think stands with his early work or his best work?
I don't think anything, to be honest and fair as a biographer who prides himself in telling it like it is, I don't think anything in the last decade, I don't think anything in the last 25 years stands up to the golden era. But I think, anybody else who were to release some of these products would be blessed to have those in the last decade. There are a couple that are diamonds in the rough. From the Dust Returned came out in 2001, I think. You might want to fact check that, but I'm almost sure it's 2001. And that is the story of his Illinois family. It was a novel he started in the 40s and never finished. There's a story called The Homecoming that he published in 1945, which is sort of the centerpiece of that novel. Uh-huh. It's about a kind of a vampire family that lives in northern Illinois with one child, the point of view character of the novel, who is not a monster, who is not a creature of the night. And, he pines for the powers of his brethren, his family. And it's really a story about puberty and feeling like an outcast. That's a remarkable, remarkable book. The other one that I think you touch on, Magical Bradbury is the sequel to Dandelion Wine, which is called Farewell Summer. I think that has elements of classic Bradbury in it. My only objective issue with the book is that I've seen the original manuscript, and it was way longer, and I think he's become a much more minimalistic writer post-stroke.
You touch on that a little bit, talking about – you touch on that some.
Yeah, more dialogue-driven, and I think that's an affectation of the theater. And I think some of the prose sometimes is a little too sparse for my own liking. I long for the classic poetry of Ray Bradbury, where you get these – what he would call pensées, which are these French prose poems, these grand – ornate descriptions of a setting, and those seem to be lacking in more of the recent work, and I pine for those. But I would say From the Dust Returned and Farewell Summer are two books that you can still encounter Ray Bradbury of yesteryear.
Are there things you've seen in the archives, in the dusty corners, that you wish would be published or finished, or you think are things that you just wish had had a different life than the ones they've lived?
Oh, well, yeah, there's several. I think he's been really mining the archives for the last 10 years and releasing. A lot of the short story collections that have come out are largely comprised of half-finished short stories from the last quarter century that he has finished. So a lot of it's been released. There's a novel that I'm trying to push him to finish, but I don't know whether he has the energy to do it, that he started. It would be his second science fictional novel. It has a spiritual, religious theme at its center. I'd like to see him work on that. There are still some stories from Dandelion Wine that haven't come out that he cut that are very good. There was a story called Dial 00 that he really wrote for a documentary that was made on him in 1962 that they released sort of the rough version of it in a specialty edition book last year or the year before, but it's never been truly finished. It's a remarkable sort of Twilight Zone-esque story about a television or a telephone sort of gaining intelligence and prank calling people and terrorizing them. It's really spooky and creepy and darn good. The other thing that I'd love to see the light of day, and it will, but I imagine after he's no longer with us, sadly, are his letters. He is a fantastically prolific letter writer, which was really surprising to me. I thought, he's written more than just about any of his contemporaries, in terms of books and short stories. But yet at the same time, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of incredibly well-crafted and poetic letters to some remarkable people out there. Very famous people, you know, contemporaries of his time, writers and film directors. And I think that would be a great book to release, a book of Bradbury's letters. So I think this stuff will trickle out, but I'm also a little nervous about it because there's a reason a lot of the fiction is not out there. Because he started it and for one reason or another didn't deem it ready to be published. And I think it's really dangerous to a person's sterling legacy to go back and start pilfering the filing cabinets and not being able to have the same energy and abilities of when the story was first written to go back, and I think there's a threat of doing damage to it. There's a reason Bradbury didn't release it in the first place, and I think that needs to be very carefully weighed.
Do you have a formal or informal role as with him in terms of publishing at this point?
No, it's very informal. I mean, everything that we have done has been done out of pure love. I mean, that's the way the guy works. He is, you know, from a Midwestern point of view, you'd call him a handshake and a beer kind of guy. We've never had any sort of contract. He's never asked for a dime out of any of my two books. He's never asked for any oversight over any of the two books, or either of the two books.
I was actually thinking more the other way.
In terms of his archives and things?
Yeah.
No, you know, that'll go to his family, and he has a principal bibliographer who has never really, you know, written anything on Bradbury's life, but catalogs all of it meticulously. His name is Don Albright, and Ray has known him since late 50s or early 60s, and he catalogs all of Bradbury's papers. So Albright will oversee that, you know, and he's been sort of instrumental in letting a lot of this stuff come out in specialty presses in the last few years. So he'll oversee it. Right now, from what I understand, there's a Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at University of Indiana, which has a great science fiction collection, and the papers will all go there. But I think the final oversight on all of it will go to his four daughters. You know, I think that they're very protective of their dad. He's very paternal and loving to his four daughters and eight grandchildren and wants them to have an estate to help them. So I think he'll leave all power of decision. From what I understand, it's not something that we really talk about a lot. Like, can I see your will?
I guess the question I'm leading to is his affairs in a position where a respectful release of material can be expected, unlike, say, Jimi Hendrix? the disaster that has been, you know.
That greatly concerns me. I think that there could be a Gatling gun's worth of Bradburyana coming out. Mm-hmm. That I think somebody who is protective of his legacy, and I'm only saying that from what's come out in the last 5 years. I mean, it seems like Gauntlet Press, which publishes beautiful books, but there are these deluxe editions, has been releasing a lot, and I don't think it's a lot of stuff that he just never published. And you got to stop and say, well, why didn't he publish it?
Uh-huh.
And I know him well enough to say, well, it wasn't ready. So why is it coming out now? Because I think he just wants his legacy, everything, to be out there now. I think it's just, for him, it's sort of, you know, he wants people to recognize that he's important, you know, and so he's letting it all go. But I don't think the 35 or 40-year-old Ray Bradbury would feel the same way, mm-hmm. personally.
Do you think he has a good grip on his own mortality, you know, the boy who was told to live forever?
Yeah, wow.
I guess this whole series of questions is kind of, one state of affairs could be in a disastrous state if one does not acknowledge that at age 90 one could go tomorrow for no good reason at all. And you know, if one's not resigned to die, one can leave kind of a mess.
God, great question. That's a really good question. Yeah, that's quite possible. I think, you know, he's matter of fact about the fact that he is a human being and eventually he's going to die. I think he knows that. I don't think he's under any guise that Mr. Electrico tapped him on the sword with a sword and that he'll be immortal. But I think there might be a little bit of a perhaps an element of, I don't want to confront this too heavily, so why deal with all my affairs in their totality and shore up everything and cross every T and dot every I because it's a downer. So why not, instead of doing that, let's just go work on a new essay or a short story instead. And so I think you're right that the affairs might not be completely connected and shored up. That's just my sense. Again, I mean, it's not my business with the family to tell them what to do. And I know his daughters love him profusely. So I think on that level, he'll be well taken care of. But he did tell me Saturday, you know, three whatever days ago. I'm kind of confused because I've been traveling. He looked at me and he said, it was a very quiet moment. There was a bunch of people in his house. And he said, come here. And he said, I may be getting ready to sell the rights to Martian Chronicles again for a film. And that will give me some good money. And I want you to look into my grandparents' home in Waukegan, Illinois, to see if it's possible to buy it. It's just a small home. It was immortalized much more fantastically in Dandelion Wine. It's this grand Victorian house. It's not that, but it's a charming little American farmhouse. And he asked me to look into the possibility of if it could be purchased. And that indicates to me that the man's thinking in terms of some sort of
homecoming.
Yep. Damn right.
I know it's only been a couple of days. Have you made the inquiries yet?
You know, I've just been thinking through my mind. I know most of the powers that be up in Waukegan because I've spoken up there, and I know the man I need to go to. I've spoken with the mayor in the past about it. Hemingway, of course, has his home and museum in Oak Park, Illinois, and Steinbeck has a museum, and so that's something I'll probably be doing this week. I promised him that I would look into its availability. I know the home is currently owned. It's a private residence. But in the past decade, it's been on and off the market a few times, and it's affordable. So that's something that I intend on doing this week for him.
Are you absolutely certain he won't live forever?
Geez. It sounds like a crazy question, you know, and a hokey, but it's not. No, I'm not, actually. There's something so mystical about him, and that sounds just ridiculous, but... You know, I was thinking the other night in my own home, and the lights were off, and I was walking downstairs to get a glass of water, and I really believe that there was something in that encounter with Mr. Electrico. There was something there that was mystical. I truly believe that. It's just too profound of a story. That's why I spent so much time talking about it in my book, that I think that there was some sort of electrical charge, some sort of life spirit. Sounds very Shirley MacLaine, but something was there because I think he has been so full of energy and so filled with fire. And I think that moment instigated it. And I think that I've been blessed to have encountered that fire and have sort of touched it. And hopefully I pray and hope absorb a little bit of it. So I have some in me, but this past weekend, I see that as he ages and you know, becomes, you know, less healthy, that the fire is diminishing just a little bit, and that makes me very sad. The light just isn't as bright, but the light is still there. It brings me great sorrow to see that it diminish a little, but there's some, who knows? I mean, I do think the guy could really surprise us and stick it out for a lot longer because of this innate and intense will to live.
I think we've all known people, seen people who are otherwise, have nothing wrong with them outside of being old, who just one day give up and 2 days later they're dead.
That's it.
Not you know, suicide, just, you know, okay, I'm done here.
That's it. It's the will to live. And that concerns me. I mean, I think that scares me because, you know, someone said, over the weekend at his birthday party, here's to 10 more great years. And he said, we'll see. And the old Ray Bradbury would have said, you're goddamn right.
Did you, in writing the biography, make any attempt to emulate him in any way, and I don't mean that stylistically. I mean more in terms of, say, the enthusiasm, because it reads very quickly and sort of a kind of gallops along.
You're kind of saying that. I mean, stylistically, when I first started out working on it, there was elements stylistically of him, and I needed to sort of purge that. It felt weird, and the only reason that it was there was because he's been an influence on me as a writer, and I needed to sort of purge the poetry. It didn't really belong in a biography, so I sort of got that out of my system early, in an early draft, early chapters. But certainly, I think the number one reason that he has connected with me and I have connected with him is because our energy is similar, and we both have this enthusiasm and excitability and gratitude. We're thrilled by the notion of ideas. We're thrilled by the act of creating and grateful to do it. We both are dumbfounded by writers who complain about writing. Get out of it, then. I mean, why did you get into it? You know, yeah, writing can be arduous and a chore when you box yourself into some sort of logistical corner, or you don't know where to go, or, you know, there's moments where it's rough, no doubt, but why did you get into it? And why do so many writers ditch? You know, this is so taxing, it's the closest thing to giving birth. You know, and so many writers complain about that it's the closest thing to death. And it's like, well, why on earth would you do that? And we share a similar opinion on that there's no greater high than the creative high. And so I think there's a lot of similarities. And so to answer your question, I'm sorry to be long-winded, but the enthusiasm in the language of my biography is just a part of my own approach to life and living. I pride myself in being energetic and full of ideas, and I write. If you were to look at all the articles I've written long before the first book came out, I mean, it's the same energy. I tend to write quickly. I like to get on a roll and have a consistency in energy in rhythm. And so I think if you complete things, that's very Bradburian. So his approach to writing was very influential on me. I think writing an early draft fast creates a identifiable and palpable energy to the prose. Then when you labor over something for too long and overthink it, and it becomes contrived and even clunky.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned being read Bradbury in the womb. Was that for your mother or for you?
Yeah, that was for my mom.
Okay. And what was that again?
I'm sorry?
And what was it that was read to
my dad read The Illustrated Man to my mom while she was pregnant with me during the blizzard of January 1967, which sort of just ravaged the Midwest. And he read a lot of books aloud, but one of them, they both loved Bradbury. And I think just to keep her company and entertain her, would read books. It's a strange book to read because it's dark and pretty damn scary. But, you know, as a lot of audio scientists would, you know, would tell you, that there's been some theories that playing classical music to a child in utero has an effect on brain development. So, I mean, my joke has always been, you know, I didn't listen to Mozart, but I listened to Bradbury, and it affected me to the point that I'm his biographer.
But it was not Bradbury exclusively, though, was it?
No, I think there were other writers in there, but my dad always told me very early on, you know, I used to read Ray Bradbury to your mother when she was carrying you. He never even remembered what the other books were, because he loved Bradbury so much. But he did say that he read other works to my mom. To be fair, but the one he always remembered, even when I was a teenager, was Ray Bradbury. He said, you know, I read Ray Bradbury to you when you were in the womb. Here's the book, and he gave me The Illustrated Man, and I read it when I was 11.
Was that your first exposure, conscious exposure?
That was my first conscious exposure. It was a story called The Long Rains. Uh-huh. It's in The Illustrated Man, and I don't know if you've ever read it, but it's just incredible.
Yeah, The Illustrated Man was the one, and I remember, was it your book where you talk about the illustration of that, the cover illustration on the paperback version? I had that version too.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah, the original is hanging on his wall when you walk in the door.
Yeah, I remember that illustration well.
I love that painting, and the story is called The Long Rain. I think I told you Long Rain, but it's Long Rain. And that was my first conscious encounter with him.